Okay, it's been a pretty long time now. I don't know, it's been a month or longer than a month, you think?
A little bit longer, maybe.
Yeah, so I'm sure you've enjoyed your Thursday morning sleeping in, but good to see you. I thought that we could kind of summarize where we've been and where we're going, and then probably next week dive into the tabernacle, because we're in the tabernacle next week. Which is, to us, maybe one of the most boring parts of the Pentateuch, but actually, I think we're going to see, is the highlight of the Pentateuch. So, more than ever, I realize that section is what the first five books of the Bible are all about, and there's a sense in which the idea behind that section is what the whole Bible's about. Life with God in the house of God is sort of the story of the Bible, but we'll get into that next time. But we have come to Exodus chapter 25, and Exodus chapter 25 is a good time to summarize, because being at Exodus chapter 25 means we're right at the heart of the Pentateuch. So this is sort of a central section. In terms of the book of Exodus itself, we're at a transition stage. You have Exodus chapter 1 through 14, which is this, you remember this great deliverance, and then Exodus 15 to 18 is God bringing Israel through the wilderness, and then 19 through 24 is what they call the Book of the Covenant. So it's all these laws that we talked about, and we talked about the purpose of the laws and all of that, and then 25 through 31 is the tabernacle, 32 through 34 is Israel messing up, basically committing adultery on their wedding night. And then 35 through 40 is, or 35 through the end of the chapter, or through the end of the book, would be the tabernacle again. It's going to be interesting. It's almost like a repeat of 25 through 31, almost really word for word. But so that's where we are in Exodus, but you can't really read Exodus by itself. So it's one of the things I hope that we're seeing as we read through the Pentateuch, is that even though these are five books, they're five books that are meant to be read together. And they're meant to be read together because they tell one story. So they're all connected. And if you read the story, Genesis to Deuteronomy, as one story, we're kind of in the middle section. We're just hitting what's going to be the longest section, actually. So this is a high point. And it literally is a high point because geographically, do you remember where they are in Exodus 25? They're right by a mountain. They're by Mount Sinai. And so they're going to be at Mount Sinai all the way until Numbers chapter 10. So from Exodus 19 to Numbers 10, which is a large chunk of the Pentateuch, they're at this mountain, Mount Sinai. And the previous section, Exodus 15 to 18, is kind of them on the way to Mount Sinai. And then Numbers 10 and following is them going away from Mount Sinai. So this is a climactic central section in the Pentateuch. And so it's a good time for us to just kind of stop and think about where we've been and what's going on. Also, because we just finished up one of the most important sections in the Pentateuch theologically, to the whole story. And I think you could say one of the more important sections, even in terms of the whole Bible. We were in chapters 19 through 24, you remember what we were looking at. We were looking at all these laws, this covenant that God made with Israel, but then all these laws. So there's the Ten Commandments and these other laws. So this is a section on the law, the giving of the law. And the law is a big thing in the Bible, obviously. It talks about the law a lot. Can you think of any sections in the Old Testament that talk about the believer's attitude towards the law?
Psalm
does. The whole Psalm 1. You got to delight in it. Blessed is the man who delights in it. Psalm 19 is this is life-changing. And then the longest psalm, is like every verse, right? Law, 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 law. God's law is amazing. So the law is obviously important in the Old Testament. And it's also something that gets a lot of people confused. The law, like, what are we supposed to do with it? And it even got people confused in the New Testament. You could say that Jesus, one of the reasons why he was crucified was a wrong interpretation of the law, wrong understanding of the law and what the law was supposed to do. Certainly that's where there was a lot of conflict between him and the Pharisees. And then later on in the New Testament, even after Paul went around preaching the gospel, you remember there was that little group that would follow Paul a lot of times when he would leave the churches he planted, and then they would come and they'd like try to confuse the church about the law. And then Paul would have to write books, which was part of God's design. But Galatians is one of those books. And a big problem in Galatians is a confusion about how are we supposed to relate to the law of God. And so even now, a lot of people are confused about this section of the Bible, about the law. And sometimes you can understand why they're confused, because you open up Genesis to Deuteronomy, and there is a lot of law. There's 613 commands. And we can ask, well, what is it doing here? What's going on? Why did God give all these laws? How are we supposed to relate to them? I've been reading this really good book lately called Reading Moses, Seeing Jesus. Reading Moses, Seeing Jesus. And it's written by these Jewish Christians who are scholars, but they're Jewish Christians. And they wrote it because they live in Israel, and they're asked a lot of times about the law. And they're asked, are we supposed to keep the law? What's the purpose of the law? How does the law fit into these five books that we're reading now? And then because they're Jewish believers, they're often asked about the law and the New Testament. And so one of the reasons why they're asked that is because if you open up the New Testament's pretty clear. The law is about Jesus. And we use the law, so we use it like really technically, so we're just thinking the commands, but the law, you could just use that same phrase to describe the first five books of the Bible, because law, Torah, just means instruction. But they're asked, okay, you say that the law, these first five books and all of this, is meant to lead us to Jesus. And you say that because Jesus says that, right? Like John 5:46, he's talking to the Pharisees. He's like, if you guys had actually read Moses, then you'd be excited about me because Moses wrote of me. And then that's a big point in the Gospel of Luke. Remember at the end where he's walking with those disciples and they're all like, ah, I'm so sad. And Jesus is like, you guys are really being fools here, because Moses, if you had paid attention to Moses, you would know that this is exactly what needed to happen. And it says there at the end of Luke, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. And so when he says Moses, he's talking about what we're reading here, the Pentateuch. So Jesus believed that as we read this, it's supposed to point people to him. It's supposed to point us to him. So we believe that, but the question is, like, could you prove that? Like, how could you demonstrate that these first five books actually are about Jesus? And maybe one of the challenges to doing that feels like a challenge to doing that, is like Exodus 19 to 24, you're like reading about what to do when you have slaves, and say like, okay, how do all these laws, is that actually what Moses thought he was doing when he wrote this? Are these really meant to help us want a Messiah? And so the way I want to see the answer to that question is by first noticing what these first five books are clearly not about. So I want to show you that Genesis through Deuteronomy, even though there's a lot of law, Moses is clearly, he's making it so clear in the very way that he writes these books, that these books are not about, they're not about Israel successfully keeping the law and fulfilling the covenant. And one way to demonstrate that is just to look at the beginning and the end of the story. So usually if you think about a story, you look at the beginning, and I'll often look at the ending now to see if it's worth reading the whole book because you don't have much time. So you look at the ending, you're like, okay, then it's worth it to go through or not. But you do that because it gives you a sense of where the story is headed. And so we'll start with the beginning, just to remember. And the beginning in the Pentateuch is especially important because the beginning of the Pentateuch is sort of like an argument why we even have the rest of the five books. And the beginning is Genesis 1 to 11. So if you want to think, okay, what's the introduction to the Pentateuch? You would say Genesis 1 to 11. And one reason, looking at beginnings, this is a little Bible study tip. One reason looking at beginnings in the Bible, especially in the Pentateuch, is so important is because of how God teaches in the Pentateuch. So there's a kind of a strategy that God uses in the Pentateuch that's really cool, I think. But his strategy is someone does something at the beginning, and then later you'll see it's repeated by someone else. And so there's a name, I can't say it in Hebrew, but Jewish rabbis used to have a name for this, and they would say, the deeds of the fathers are assigned to the sons. The deeds of the fathers are assigned to the sons. And that means, and I'm quoting here, but it says, Moses wrote stories about the fathers, not only to tell us about the fathers, but also to point forward to what would happen to the descendants of the fathers. So you're looking in the Pentateuch, you'll find something happening to the father. And part of what's that the way God's working in history there is he's giving you a pattern to understand what is going to happen later. And it's amazing once you start seeing how often that's what's going on in the Pentateuch. So one illustration of that would be the Exodus. So if you go back to the Exodus is not really a surprise when you understand like this way that God works. And so if you look at Abram in Genesis chapter 12, so we can go to Genesis chapter 12, verse 10. So Abram's the first father, I guess, the first big father here. And Genesis 12, 10. Someone want to read Genesis 12, 10.
And there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to dwell there, for the famine was severe in the land.
So what are some of the things that we have there?
Famine.
We have a famine.
Egypt.
We even have a way of describing how he went to Egypt called a descent to Egypt. And then, you know, we turn later to Genesis, and you know what we find? We find his descendants experiencing the exact same thing. So there's a famine, and then it says, it actually uses the same Hebrew word. It says Jacob and his sons descended to Egypt. And then what happens next to Abram, Genesis 12, 12? So what is Abram saying is going to happen there?
He's going
to die. So he says the Egyptians are going to kill him, but are they going to kill Sarah?
Mm-hmm.
No. So you could say this is a life-threatening situation for the male in Egypt, but not for the female. And, of course, that's what happens in Exodus chapter 1. The males are attacked. The firstborn sons are attacked. And not the females. And then Sarah is taken into the service of Pharaoh, and Abram is blessed. So Sarah has to almost serve Pharaoh, and Abram is blessed as a result, and he gets all kinds of things. But what happens to Pharaoh? Genesis chapter 12, verse 20.
So Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had.
Yeah, so Pharaoh actually forces forces Abram to leave. And why does he do that, verse 17?
But the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarah, Abraham's wife.
Okay, so... Yeah, so that's, and of course, that's what God does in Exodus, right? So, and we see in Genesis 12:16 and 13:2 that Abram leaves Egypt very wealthy because of all the things Pharaoh had given him. And that's pretty much what happened when Israel left Egypt as well. And the reason I point that out is because it's like a feature of the Pentateuch. You read something happening, and it points you to what is going to happen. And, if you can probably think of some really obvious examples of that, even as you read the rest of Genesis. You'll read a story about Abram doing something with his wife, like he does here, and then you're like, oh, wow, didn't I read this story before, when you read about Isaac. And so you read something in the Pentateuch, and it often points you to what's going to happen. And that's important to keep in mind as you look at the beginning of the story, and especially the story of Adam and Eve. So the story of Adam and Eve gives you a hint of what is going to happen as you read the rest of the story. And so what happens at the beginning of the Pentateuch, if we just remember with Adam and Eve? You got Genesis 1, and look at Genesis chapter 1, verse 28 specifically. So he's talking about Adam and Eve here. God makes a world, and then he talks to Adam and Eve. And let's look at what he does. Genesis 1:28.
And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth.
Okay, so what does God, if we just pick apart what God does here, what's the first thing God does for Adam and Eve? He blesses them. And then what does he tell them to do?
Be fruitful, multiply.
And then he tells them to have what? Dominion over all the things of the earth. And actually the word earth there is mostly translated in the Bible land. So you could read that subdue the things that are in the land. Basically, it's like have dominion over the land, subdue the land. So you have blessing, you have be fruitful, and you have this whole concept of the land. The land is yours to rule. Where do you hear that again? Blessing, be fruitful, land, those three words. Where do you hear that again?
Abraham,
Genesis chapter 12. So God pretty much, in Genesis chapter 12, takes what he says to Adam, and then he uses those same exact elements when he talks to Abram about what he's going to do through Israel. Okay, and what for? Why did God do this? Back to Genesis 1, or I guess now Genesis chapter 2. So God puts Adam in this world. He's like, this is my plan. I want you to be blessed. I want you to be fruitful. I want you to rule over the land. And why am I doing all this? How does Genesis 2 begin? Genesis 2, 1 through 3.
As the heaven and the earth were filled by finishing by all the hosts of them, and on the seventh day God finished his work that he had had, and he rested on the seventh day for all the works he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all this work that he has done in creation.
So I always thought it was weird what they did here, whoever did the chapters and verse divisions, because I always thought, man, it's weird they divide the seventh day from the first day. And of course, we know these aren't inspired, these chapter divisions. But they were written by guys who knew the Bible. They were put in there not by like a computer or something. They were like guys who really were immersed in the scripture. And they did it for a reason. And yet this always seems strange to me. Why would they do that? Until I realized that the seventh day is a really special part of the creation account. And there's someone who actually has written, last in creation, first in intention, the Sabbath is the end of the creation of the heaven and earth. In other words, it's the purpose. So the Sabbath is the goal of creation. And we usually would think of the creation of man as the climax, but actually the Sabbath is the climax of the creation account. And there's all kinds of cool ways Moses points that out, but like, for example, the first word in Genesis, the first sentence in Genesis 1 is a seven-word sentence. And then he divides the way that he tells the creation account into seven paragraphs. And you can see when he describes the seventh day, he repeats himself three times. On the seventh day, God finished his work. He rested on the seventh day from all his work. So God blessed the seventh day. And then Moses sets this day apart in a way that's special in verse 1. He says, "Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them." So God's creation is done. And if you look at the way that the creation account is told, day 1, day 2, day 3, day 4, day 5, day 6 are all like parallel. So like he does something in day 1, which creates a category. Then day 4, he fills in the category. Day 2, day 5, day 3, day 6. And then day 7 kind of has no parallel. It's on its own. And then he really emphasizes the importance in verse 3 where it says he blessed the seventh day and made it holy. And that's the only time in Genesis where God makes anything holy. And he actually is blessing a day. It's kind of interesting. So God, it's kind of like an exclamation here, point here. This is really important. And it's important because it's the purpose of creation. God designed the whole world for peace and rest, for this, and doesn't have day and night. You know, it doesn't have, there was morning, there was evening. It's just supposed to be like this continual shalom is the idea, continual satisfaction, continual rest. And that's why I think it fits here in chapter 2, because chapter 2 is really about what God's goal for Adam and Eve is. So it's almost like an introduction to the rest of the chapter. And the goal is that they would dwell in his presence. And so this is going to fit with the tabernacle, actually, because the Garden of Eden and the tabernacle are really connected. So that's sort of like pointing you forward how the tabernacle fits into the story. Like, this is God's goal, is he wants to live with his people. And we're going to get to that more next week. But the key to them dwelling with his presence is what? They need to obey a command. They need to obey his command. And so God takes them, he puts them in this really special place, and then he gives them a law, Genesis 2, chapter 17. And then, of course, we know Genesis chapter 3, they don't keep it. So there's a serpent in the garden, the serpent deceives Eve, and what should have happened? What should have happened is Adam and Eve subdue the serpent, but instead the serpent kind of subdues them, and as a result, they're sent out of the garden to the east. And you could say that they're exiled from the garden. They're exiled from the garden. And if you keep reading in the story, in Genesis 11, you'll see that their descendants are in a place called Babel, and that's literally Babylon. And in Babylon, they're judged. Which, why am I telling you that? If you know the rest of the Old Testament, what you kind of, that just told you the story of the rest of the Old Testament, actually. That's like, if you go Genesis to the end of Kings, that's exactly what happens to Israel. God chooses Israel. He blesses Israel. He makes them fruitful. He gives them laws. He places them in this really special land, which he describes as being like the Garden of Eden. He calls on them to subdue the land. But what happens is they're disobedient and they're deceived by the people who live in the land. Even in Joshua, you think almost right when they get there, they're deceived by those people from Gibeon. They're deceived by people in the land, and they break God's commandments, and they end up being sent into exile. And even the city ends up being the same city that they're sent into exile. They're sent to a place called Babylon. So that's one way the beginning of the story gets you ready for what to expect as you read the story of Israel. Adam's put in a perfect place, and he can't keep one commandment. He's like a perfect guy in a perfect place. He's given one very easy command because there's like lots of other trees. There's lots of food. And he can't keep that one commandment. And he's sent into exile, which is a way of saying at the very beginning of the Pentateuch, this is not going to be about Israel being able to keep all these laws, because Israel's wicked and they're given 613 commandments. So Adam, in a perfect place, couldn't keep even one. So you're at the point, your hopes are not high for Israel, especially since you see so many patterns in the Pentateuch where the sons did exactly what their fathers did. I mean, all of Genesis, that's probably why, part of why there's so much repetition there. It's like getting you sort of into how the symphony is going to go. You know, like at the beginning of a long symphony, you get these certain chords that's like, okay, I'm going to listen for these later. And in the beginning of the symphony, Genesis, you're like, oh, wow, the son does exactly what the father does. The son does exactly what the father does. Adam, one command, breaks it, deceived, sent into exile. Huh, I wonder what's going to happen to Israel. Now, on the other hand, what's cool is these opening chapters aren't without hope. Because while they don't give you much hope that Israel is going to be able to keep the law, they sort of nudge you to look somewhere different. So I can't look to Israel, but where do I look? Is this just going to be like a hopeless story? And one way you see that there is a little bit of hope is by thinking for a minute about the last story in Genesis 1 to 11, and that's the story of the Tower of Babel. So you know this story. It's after the flood. The people gather together. This is all of creation, basically. All the people on the planet gathering together to do what Adam did. But why do they gather together? Genesis 11:4. Somebody read Genesis 11:4. So they don't want to obey God, but they do want to do what for themselves?
Make a name.
Make a name. So they want glory. And why would they want glory? If you don't believe that you're going to live forever, how do you live forever? You make a name for yourself. Now, the Hebrew word for name is actually Shem. So the word Shem means name. So they're basically saying, we want to make a Shem for ourselves. So if you've been reading Genesis 1 to 11, it's not surprising, again, that you find them doing this. Because Genesis 4, remember the story of Adam and Eve? They have these sons, Cain and Abel. Cain's envious of Abel, so he murders him. Genesis 4 through 11, or Genesis 4, 11 and 12, God says to Cain, you're going to be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth. And the Hebrew word for wanderer is nod. And then Genesis 4:16, Cain says, Cain goes away from God. He's sent away from the presence of the Lord, and he settles in the land of Nod, east of Eden. So God says, you're going to be a Nod, and Cain goes and lives in the land of Nod. He's a wanderer living in the land of wandering. And he is scared. He says to God, If you do this to me, I'm going to be killed. And God says to Cain, actually, I am going to protect you. I'm going to take care of you. You're not going to be killed. But Cain can't trust that God's going to be faithful to his promises. So you know what Cain does is he builds himself a city. And so he builds himself a city so that he doesn't have to rely on God's protection of him. He doesn't want to have to trust God. That God will protect him, so he builds a city to protect himself, which is kind of similar to what's going on in Genesis 11. Let's build a city so we don't have to trust God, so we don't have to exercise faith in God's promises, so we don't have to do what God wants. And how does the plan end? They want to build a city to make a name for themselves. But what are the names of the guys who built that city? Yeah, that's a good answer, because we don't know the names of the guys that build that city. So the plan doesn't work. But God does give their city a name. And it's Babel, which literally means confusion. So it's like God is showing how smart their project was. Instead of getting glory for themselves, he's like, This is the one name you're gonna remember from this story. It's like confusion, chaos. You guys, in refusing to trust me, this is the result of it. You don't get the name, but I'll give you a name, which is basically like stupidity. It doesn't work. And they're spread out all over the earth, which is a kind of exile, right? They're sent out in all over the earth. That's the problem. And then Genesis 12 is the solution. And yet, what do we get before Genesis 12? Genesis 11:10 says what?
This is the genealogy of Shem.
Okay, yeah, we can stop there. This is the genealogy of Shem. So literally, this is the genealogy of name. So we want to make a name for ourselves. It doesn't work. The very next story is, let me tell you about name. And who comes from name? It's Abram. Abram comes from name. So trusting in themselves to make a name doesn't work. What will work? Well, we're kind of being led in the direction here because God uses the very name to point us that way. And then he makes a promise in Genesis 12:2. And what does he say to Abram in Genesis 12:2? Yeah, so I think that is already in the Pentateuch is pointing us to the solution. Like, the solution is not taking things into our own hands, because all that's going to do is end in confusion. But the solution is going to be in God and trusting God and his promise. But that's just the beginning. That's just the beginning. What's the Pentateuch about? The beginning shows us it is not about Israel being able to save themselves and fulfill the covenant. What is it going to be about? It's going to be about God acting to save. Now go to the ending, Deuteronomy 29 to 34. And with all that set up, the ending of the story is not going to be very surprising. He renews the covenant with Israel in Deuteronomy 29. So this is like right before they're going to try to enter the land. But then Deuteronomy 30 verse 1. Look at what Moses says, Deuteronomy chapter 30 verse 1.
Blessing and the curse which I have set before you, and you call them to mind among all the nations where the Lord your God has driven you.
So what does that tell you about what Moses expects? He's just renewed the covenant with the second generation, and this is right after he gives them all these laws and saying, okay, if you obey, we're going to be blessed. If you disobey, you're going to be sent into exile. What hint does that verse give you that of what how Moses expects this is going to end? Where are they calling to God from?
All the nations.
So what does that tell you about where they are? Or where they're not?
They're not in the promised land.
Yeah, so where were they supposed to be if they obeyed?
In the promised land.
Yeah.
Together.
So he's assuming from the beginning here that they're not going to keep the covenant. Then Deuteronomy 31, 16 to 21. This is a little longer, but Deuteronomy 13, 16 to 21. This is actually God speaking here about what is going to happen. Deuteronomy 31, 16 to 21.
Many evils and troubles have come upon them, this song shall confront them as a witness, for it will live unforgotten in the mouths of their offspring. For I know what they are inclined to do even today, before I have brought them into the land that I swore to give.
Yeah, and so there's one more just like that in Deuteronomy 32 as well, which tells you what? If this is how the book of Deuteronomy ends. Does that basically tell you?
Like a big cycle, God knows the
inclination. Yeah, right. And it tells you that Moses kind of expects that Israel's going to fail. And God says that they're going to fail. Which makes you ask, wait, what's going on? Because there's a lot about Israel. And there's a lot of work. There's a lot of laws here. And there are parts of the story that gets our hopes up for Israel. I mean, Genesis 12, they're the solution to the problem. Genesis 19, there's this big promise, or Exodus 19, there's this big promise made to Israel. If you'll obey, you'll be this really solution to the curse. But Israel's going to fail. So what hope is there, and why is there all this law? This is where the writers of the New Testament help us a lot, because they come alongside of us and they tell us. If you look at Romans chapter 4, verse 15, look at what Paul says is one of the purposes of the law. This is not all there is to it, but this is something Paul points out, Romans 4, 15.
The law brings wrath, but where there is no law, there's no transgression.
Okay, so he's saying one of the purposes of the law is to expose sin, and where did Paul get that idea? Well, I think he got that idea reading the Pentateuch, reading this story, and let me show you even more specifically, and I'll show you that by pointing out how Israel did before the law and how they did after receiving the law. So this is pretty well known, but I was saying earlier, Israel's time at Mount Sinai is the heart of the Pentateuch. So that's from Exodus 19 and Numbers 10. But imagine this big mountain, and underneath the mountain you could write Exodus 19 to Numbers 10. Right before that, though, Israel's coming to the mountain. So that's Exodus 15 to 18. And then right after that, Numbers 10, Israel's leaving the mountain. So Exodus 15 to 18, coming to the mountain. Mountain, Exodus 19 to Numbers 10, and then Israel leaving the mountain, Numbers 10. Now, this is important because those two sections, Exodus 15 to 18 and Exodus Numbers 10 and following, are parallel. So you have Israel before the law, and then you have Israel after the law. And one of the really interesting things that Moses does is before the law and after the law, it's like you're watching the same video. At a different, it's like Israel here is going through certain things, then there's all this time, and then they're going through certain things, and they're basically the same things. So before the law, after the law. So we're seeing, how did Israel do before the law? How did Israel do after the law? Well, let's look at real quickly at how Israel did before the law. Exodus 15, 22 to 24. 22 and 24, we'll read some of the story. Exodus 15, 22 and 24.
Then Moses made Israel set out from the Red Sea, and they went into the wilderness of Shur. They went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. And 24.
And then how'd they respond there?
And the people grumbled against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?"
Okay, so they have a 3-day journey. And they complain. Then Exodus chapter 16, verse 3. Here's another time they're grumbling after. This is after. It's another setting. But Exodus 16, verse 3.
Children of Israel said to them, "Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat and when we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole as assembly with hunger."
Yeah. So they here are wishing they could go back to Egypt, and longing for the food of Egypt. Then 16:4 to 24, God gives them manna and quail. Chapter 16, verse 27, they disobey the Sabbath command that God had given them. They disobey what he says about the seventh day. Exodus 17, they quarrel with Moses and say, "Why'd you bring us out of Egypt?" We could read all these. So they question, "Is God among us?" They get upset about God giving them the way God gives them water, or they complain and God gives them water from the rock. They battle against the Amalekites, and then Moses is like having such a hard time leading that he has to appoint leaders to help him. So that's all before the law, and we could have looked at all that, but we didn't have time. But after, all nine of those things I just said, they all happen after as well. You can read Numbers. I wrote all the verses down here, but you could read that yourself. So literally, it's like point for point. It all, before, after. Nine things happen before. Nine things happen after the law. So we have these parallel events. But what's really interesting is to look at what happens before the law after Israel does this and what happens after the law. So Exodus 17:13, what happens, Exodus 17, 13, is they sin, they fight the Amalekites, and they win. Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the sword. But then you go to Numbers chapter 14. Um, 43 through 45, they sin and all this, and they actually fight the Amalekites again. And what happens in Numbers 14, 43 through 45?
Were there the Amalekites and the Canaanites are facing you, and you shall fall by the sword, because you have turned back from following the Lord will not be with you. But they presumed to go up to the heights of the hill country, although neither the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord nor Moses departed out of the camp. Then the Amalekites and the Canaanites who lived in that hill country came down and defeated them and pursued them even to the Horeb.
Okay, so again, remember, we're looking at parallel events where Israel does the exact same things before the law, after the law. Before the law, they do these things and they actually defeat the Amalekites. After the law, they do these things, and the Amalekites crush them. Exodus 18:18 through 22 is where Jethro tells Moses, "Hey, you need to appoint leaders because these people are too much for you." And Moses appoints leaders. But then look at Numbers 11:14 and 15. Moses knows that he needs help again here, more help, and yet in how does he feel about it this time? The first time he's kind of like, okay, let's do it. But how does he, when he realizes he needs more help this time, how does he feel in Numbers 11, 14, and 15?
"I'm not able to bear all these people alone because the burden is too heavy for me. If you treat me like this, please kill me here and now. If I have found favor in your sight,
yeah, so you just see Moses here. Now he wants to die. Exodus chapter 16, we had somebody violating the Sabbath. And what ends up happening is the Lord just says, "Hey, why are you guys not doing what I told you to do?" But Numbers 16, it's Numbers 15:36. They disobey the Sabbath. And what happens in Numbers 15:36? A guy disobeys the Sabbath.
Stoned to death.
Yeah. So I think you're getting the point. Like, if you look at every story before the law, it's like, okay. And then after the law, they do the same exact things, and there's judgment. There's wrath. So if you look at Israel, first of all, if you look at Israel before the law and after the law, they're not really transformed. They're not really any different. And what happens, though, is that the law exposes them and brings judgment on them, just like Paul says. And so what is the hope then? What is the hope? Because this is not a hopeless book. I'm trying to show you that, like, even if you just look at the first five books of the Bible, the first five books of the Bible are set up to say the hope is not in us keeping the law. It's not in us keeping the law. So if that's not the hope, is there any hope? Does the Pentateuch give us any hope? And it really does. And one way it gives us hope is by highlighting the importance of faith. So like in every big section of the Pentateuch, there's not a lot of times faith is brought up, but in every big section of the Pentateuch, faith is highlighted. So what's the story of Abram, the fundamental story? If you think about the fathers teach us something, the deeds of the fathers are signs to the sons. Abram doesn't really have the law, but what is he counted as in God's sight? Do you remember this is one of the most important sections? Paul brings this up. He is counted righteous in God's sight, even though he didn't have the law. So how is he counted righteous in God's sight? Genesis 15. He believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. The next big section, Exodus. Exodus chapter 4, verse 31. The people believe God there. They cry out to God, but then Exodus 4, 31, the people believed and worship. And then Exodus 14, verse 31, this next section, they believe. It's the end of that section. At the beginning of the Exodus, they believe. At the end of the deliverance, they believe. But you know what? They go into the wilderness, and what do they not do? They don't believe. They don't believe. And then they have all this judgment in the wilderness, and God explains, really, what the problem is. In Numbers 14:11, what does God say is the problem? Numbers 14:11.
And the Lord said to Moses, "How long will these people despise me? And how long will they not believe in me, in spite of all the signs that I've done with them?"
Yeah, so God's saying, here's the problem, is you're not believing. And then this is probably one of the, if you think about it, just who would you almost think is the hero of the Pentateuch? I mean, it's God, but in terms of an individual, you would think it's Moses, right? And yet, it's either Abraham or Moses, if you contrast them. And Moses doesn't even get to go into the land. So that's pretty shocking. Who's done all this, he's not able to go into the land. And what is the reason God gives that he's not able to go into the land? Numbers 20, 12. God says why he's not able to go into the land in Numbers 20, 12.
Because you did not believe in me?
Yeah. So it's kind of like Abraham believed and it was credited into righteousness, to him as righteousness. Moses does not believe he's not able to go into the land. So like, and this is like an earth-shaking moment. It seems kind of obvious that the Pentateuch is like saying, it's about faith. It's about faith. But faith in what? And then Moses, when he preaches Deuteronomy, he's pretty clear. This is the problem, is you did not believe. You did not believe. And then he says to Israel, you're not righteous. And again, he points out the reason they're not righteous. Is they can't obey the law, and that's like a real contrast with Abram, who didn't have the law, and it's credited to him as righteous because he had faith. So what's the hope in the Pentateuch? It's faith. It's faith. That's one, but faith in what? Well, towards the end of the Pentateuch, we realize these people need a work of God. They need a transformation, and then Moses is kind of like, I wish they all had the Spirit. So we need God to do this circumcising of the heart so they can keep the law. They need this like radical transformation. And yet, how's that going to happen? And the hope in the Pentateuch is that God has made a promise about someone he's going to send, about a Messiah. And one, he's like, where's the Messiah in the Pentateuch? Well, he's not there. There's a lot of law. The Messiah is not there very much. So you're like, how can I know the Pentateuch's really about hope in the Messiah? Well, one way is by seeing what it's not about. But another way is by thinking about how the very first words of the Bible are in the beginning. So this is a story that has a beginning. Then throughout the Pentateuch, it's mostly narrative or laws, but throughout the Pentateuch, there are these poems. There are about four big poems. And you know how most of those poems begin, or at somewhere in those poems it says, in the last days. So in the beginning, in the end. So you're like reading all these stories, and then all of a sudden there's like somebody singing. It's like watching a play, and then somebody, it's hardly anything, it's all play. And then somebody comes on and the lights go out and just there's a light, there's only one light on this person's head, like, ooh, and they sing for this really long time. You're going to remember the song. That's going to be something that stands out. Well, that's how the Pentateuch plays out. Like, story, 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 and then Moses, like, oh, are these different people, oh, Jacob, or all these other guys, oh, with the light on them. Like, okay, and they in the beginning, and they start, in the end, you know, like, let me tell you about the end. So you're like, whoa, okay, that's pointing me towards something significant. And the key part of each poem has to do with this future king, this great king who's going to come. But one of the most important ones of those poems, I only have 5 minutes, but one of the most important ones of those poems is really fun to read because it's number 24, and it's a song by like the last character that you would expect to sing an important song. Not the last, but like by a guy. So you got like Jacob, you've got like Moses singing a song. So these guys you would expect, but here's a song that's really important, and it's by this pagan prophet named Balaam. And Balaam's really kind of an interesting guy because you're like, you're listening to him singing, like, am I supposed to trust this guy or am I not supposed to trust this guy because he's not an Israelite? He seems kind of greedy. Is he good or bad? So like, you want to know, should I listen to him? And God's really cool how he does this because what happens at the beginning of sort of towards the beginning of Balaam's life? Yeah, he goes to give this, before he goes to give, not the beginning of his life, but before he goes to give this prophecy, this donkey stops him and a donkey speaks to him. And there's like, it actually is like three times when he tries to get by the donkey. And then at the third time, the donkey's like, what are you doing? He's like, if you keep doing this and you don't listen to me, you're going to die. Why does he tell that story about the donkey at the beginning? Here's this animal that is giving Balaam revelation from God that if he doesn't listen to this animal, he is going to die. This animal is not somebody you would normally look to speak for God. But in this moment, God chooses to pick up this animal and give revelation. And so that is Moses' way of saying, and God's way of saying, I know you don't expect to be able to, for Balaam to tell you anything that's significant, but I can use donkeys to speak for me. I'm going to use Balaam to speak for me. And then when Balaam goes to speak, it's like three times, it's this whole parallel to what happens with the donkey. And it's the third time that he gives this song about the end days. And the key part of his song is in Numbers 24, 5 through 9, and Numbers 24, 15 through 19. And it's the whole hope of the Pentateuch. And you can see Numbers 24, let's just read 5 through 9, and then we'll read 15 through 19, and this will be almost the end, but 5 through 9.
Lovely are your tents, O Jacob, your dwellings, O Israel, like valleys that stretch out, like gardens by the riverside, like aloes planted by the Lord, like cedars beside the waters. He shall pour water from his buckets, and his seed shall be in many waters. His king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. God brings him out of Egypt. He has strength like a wild ox. He shall consume the nations, his enemies. He shall break their bones and pierce them with his arrows. He bows down, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who shall rouse him? Blessed is he who blesses you, and cursed is he who curses you.
Okay, so it would have been good to read this right after we read Judah's song, because he sings some of the same notes that Judah does about this particular person, the Messiah. But here he's talking about this person God's going to bring out of Egypt, who is going to exercise really rule over the entire world. And blessed are those who's going to accomplish the Abrahamic covenant. Because that blessed are those who bless you, cursed are those who curse you, links it back to the Abrahamic covenant. And then he tells you more about it in Numbers 24, 17 through 19.
I see him, but now, not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. It shall crush the forehead of Moab and break down all the sons of Sheth. Edom shall be dispossessed, Seir also, his enemy shall be dispossessed. Israel is doing valiantly, and one from Jacob shall exercise dominion and destroy the survivors of cities.
And exercise dominion, of course, is pretty big when you think back to Adam's call. So he's saying, "What? I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near." And he's saying, here's the hope. God is going to raise up a conqueror, a victor, a Messiah from Israel, who is going to fulfill the Abrahamic covenant, and he's going to exercise dominion. He's going to do what I planned for Adam to do. And so the coming of the Messiah is the hope of the Pentateuch, and ultimately, like, the goal of the Pentateuch. The reason this is here is to call us, to help us understand what the Messiah is going to do, why we need a Messiah, and to call us and tell us, look, the hope is not in you, in what you're able to do through your hands, but the hope is in what God is going to do in raising up this great Messiah. So please put your faith in him, which I think is pretty cool. That's another reminder when we read the New Testament and these guys are saying all this and Jesus is saying all this, they're not making stuff up. They're not like, oh, I wish it were this way. They're really like, no, guys, go back and read the first five books carefully, and what you're going to come out is not with the Pharisees kind of religion. You're going to come out with what Jesus and the writers of the New Testament were saying, is that the hope is not in us. The hope is in what God's done through the Messiah. I hope that's exciting for you. I know it takes a little bit of work, but it's worth it.